Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio program from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Laura Kabelka in Berlin because even Kate Laycock needs a holiday every now and then. It's my first time hosting the show, so it's going to sound a bit different, not just because Kate isn't here, but because we're departing from the usual format to bring you a press freedom special.
When governments are thinking of investing in their own defense, they definitely need to factor in media, not as an instrument of their own influence, but as a basic layer of society that if you withdraw it, your society will be dysfunctional.
Press freedom is under threat. We'll unpack what's behind the decline and why it matters for the whole continent here on Inside Europe.
For the first time, conditions are ranked poor in half the world's countries.
Borders Without Borders has released its annual report.
The outlook has never looked so bleak.
The lack of press freedom in those countries has very serious.
The report says rising instability around the world, growing authoritarianism in certain countries.
It has made the work of journalists harder.
Journalists who have been detained, are missing or held hostage.
Repeatedly attacked, one was killed.
The list of worst-ranked countries grew dramatically from last year, from 36 to 52.
As you heard there, press freedom around the world has reached a historic low, according to the media watchdog Reporters Without Borders. More and more journalists and the media are coming up against increasingly hostile constraints as they try to bring people credible information free of censorship and government control. Europe is still ahead in the Global Press Index rankings, but the situation here is also deteriorating. That's why this week on Inside Europe, we're taking a closer look at how that's playing out in three countries: Georgia, Belarus, and Ukraine. All three countries share long borders with Russia. All were part of the Soviet Union until its collapse in 1991 and continue to have complex political relationships with Russia. But their levels of political independence and press freedom vary. During the recent Global Media Forum held in Bonn, Germany, I got to sit down with three women from these countries working in media and ask them, what exactly are they up against? How do journalists keep working in such environments? And what hope do they have for change? We'll start with Georgia, a small country wedged between Russia and Turkey. For the past couple of years, it's been gripped by protests. First, demonstrators marched against a Russian-inspired law forcing NGOs who receive substantial funding from abroad to register as foreign agents. Then people took to the streets over controversial parliamentary elections described by the European Parliament as neither free nor fair. And lately, they've been protesting because the government announced its intention to suspend talks to join the European Union and has been cracking down on the opposition, protesters, and media workers.
Information is a source of power because people make decisions based on information. That's why we need quality media in democracies to make power holders accountable and to inform public.
This is Tamar Kintsurashvili. She was just on Inside Europe earlier this month because she received DW's Freedom of Speech Award for her work on media literacy, fact-checking and disinformation. She's the executive director and co-founder of Georgia's Media Development Foundation, which tries to help people understand media manipulation and improve critical thinking.
And we teach media literacy because even we're fact-checkers, fact-checking is not always convincing way to change the mind of people. When you are telling someone that you are a liar, it's somehow offensive for people. And disinformation research is mostly focused on narratives because not everything is false, but the way it's framed in manipulative way, it creates tension. It's impossible to fact check all pieces of disinformation that appears in social media networks. It's important to educate public how to navigate in this complex media ecosystems.
And who are the most hostile actors in your country and what are their strategies?
Russia is a country who tries to manipulate public opinion and interfere in information space. We have Russia's military presence on the ground. And of course, domestic homegrown propaganda is the biggest challenge right now because the strategies and methods used by Russia for a long time, now opted by our own government, who tries to manipulate with people's identity, saying that creating this false dichotomy, that pervert West tries to destroy our identity, traditional one, and only Orthodox Russia could save us from this perversion. They are also using this cloned website mimicking Western platforms. So sometimes it's difficult for media consumers to differentiate real Deutsche Welle or BBC from fabricated one.
Can we talk about the level of press freedom in general in Georgia a little bit and how it has affected you? It has deteriorated in recent times, also according to Reporters Without Borders. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Unfortunately, Georgia is backsliding in terms of democracy. The first step was adoption of the so-called foreign agent law, labeling the Western-funded NGOs as foreign spies, but they are not tracking Russian money. They are targeting the Western donors who support democracy. On another side, we have unpunished violence against journalists who were physically beaten during the protests. Western journalists denied entry to the country because they are reporting from protests and informing Western society what is going on in Georgia. Journalists in exile is another issue because for a long time Georgia was safe haven from those who are repressed in their country, Russian journalists, Azerbaijani, Belarusians, and they are also not secure. Georgia is not a secure place anymore for them to stay.
But Tamar tells me it's not just journalists that are being threatened. Anyone working in media or drawing attention to misinformation is a target. And the threats they face are often violent.
In our office was vandalized twice, putting posters with my pictures saying that I'm executor of foreign orders. Masked strangers appeared near our office midnight. Pro-government media was accompanying them. And this is an illustration how this apparatus is working. Propaganda TV channels are part of these violent actions. We were also receiving threats, phone calls, including my family member, my husband and daughter. And I was receiving rape threats of me and our fact checkers after elections.
What gives you hope that there will be a better situation in Georgia soon or in the next years?
I think the resilience of Georgian society, and Georgia has quite vibrant civil society organizations. That's why we are the next target. Right now, we have most leaders of political opposition jailed, about 53 civil activists in prison, but protests, people are still protesting in order to protect our European future. This protest started when government announced that they are postponing EU accession till 2028 because this means that we are isolated from the Western world. We are in the hands of autocratic regime, but people still continue doing their job until it's possible.
Tamar Kintsurashvili, veteran journalist and disinformation fighter from Georgia. Speaking of imprisoning activists, dissenters and journalists, this next country we're looking at has the highest number of journalists behind bars in Europe. That's Belarus, with 38 journalists currently imprisoned. To understand why, let's go back to 2020, when Belarus held elections and Alexander Lukashenko, who has ruled since 1994 and is known as Europe's last dictator, claimed another win. The result sparked mass protests, and in response, he had tens of thousands of people arrested. Since then, many journalists have fled and now work from abroad, many in Poland, Lithuania, and Georgia. One group supporting them is the nonprofit Press Club Belarus, now operating in exile in Poland. Natalia Belikova, an international lawyer, leads their international cooperation work. As for the journalists who stayed behind,
if you want to do your job and you want to basically continue to be able to name yourself a journalist publicly, then you have to leave, because all the journalists have been declared basically terrorists or extremists. In reality, media consumption and media production are criminalized. If a government wants to track you down for some reason, all they need to do is just to ask you to show them your phone and see what you're subscribed, what you're reading. This would be enough to file an administrative and sometimes even a criminal case against you. Also, if you're a Belarusian journalist, then most likely you have no name. You don't talk about your sources. You cannot say you're a journalist. For example, there are cases when you're working in exile and you want to verify or know some information that has happened inside Belarus. So you call, for example, some ministry or some press service of the ministry. You cannot say that you are a journalist from media XYZ because it has been designated as extremist. So what you do, you say that you're a listener or you're a general public, you know, you're some citizen that really cares about an issue, and then ask questions from that perspective. How weird is that? That is probably breaking the very first principle of journalism, that you have to name yourself.
Right. So it's dangerous for the journalists, for their sources, and even the consumers, is what you're saying. So how do journalists reach their potential audiences?
So digital and internet is the only more or less free space. Technology here is your friend. We are helping media to use technology to bypass this blocking inside the country. The second part that media does is they are everywhere. They're multi-platform. So they try to make sure that wherever the audience is, they're present there. So right now we see lots of growth in TikTok, in YouTube. But you have to remember that it's not just good journalists that are investing in TikTok and YouTube. The government also understands that they need to exploit the new instruments of information distribution.
So the situation for journalists in the country is very difficult, almost impossible. How are journalists in exile doing? Are there repressions against them as well?
It's really amazing how you think, okay, you have escaped. But the problem is that it's an illusion of safety. We see not just that the government is extending its hand to get after, you know, the people, the physical or the digital or the cybersecurity, right, attacking the journalists. But with the other hand, they're also attacking your relatives and friends inside the country.
Natalia told me that the journalists currently in prison in her home country of Belarus are friends and family of her and her colleagues, but no information is coming through.
Some are imprisoned for 18 years, some less, 5, 7. Some, before they actually were put in prison, said, I know I will go to jail. I understand that I might spend my next 20 years there. But now, 4 or 5 years on, it's inhuman treatment. You know, being in a Belarusian jail is definitely not an experience you want to do. And I'm sure that many of them
are revising their, you know, thoughts, how they thought of it, and really thinking whether this was worth it.
Is there anything that gives you hope that the situation could improve?
As I understand that this may linger even longer, that we are in a marathon and time is racing against us. But what gives me hope is that if you're looking at a larger history, regimes come and go, you know, history has its own circle. We will get out of this. You have to understand that this may not happen within your lifetime. But I'm sure that, and this is something that gives me strength to do what I do every single day, is to know that this is not in vain, that all of this experience will be digested, analyzed, thought through, and then we will come out, different people out of this.
Oh, that's beautiful.
In the meantime, US cuts in media funding are only making the situation worse. Natalia's organization has already had to cancel one of their training programs for aspiring journalists because of it.
With the funding cuts, you will not have half of the media in Europe that was there. Then you are definitely more exposed to evil propaganda from Russia and who else is aiming, you know, to target your audience. If minds of people are infected, then there's nothing you can do.
Natalia Belikova, international lawyer with Press Club Belarus. Next up, press freedom in Ukraine. That's here with me, Laura Kabelka, on Inside Europe. A country that knows all about the danger of Russian influence is, of course, Ukraine. But it may surprise you to hear that the situation for the press right now is not nearly as bad as in Belarus or Georgia. Reporters Without Borders describe the media landscape as diverse and resilient. Before Russia's full-scale invasion, Ukraine was not ranking very high on their index. Since then, it has actually jumped up in the ranking.
Ukraine has a better situation with media freedom than you probably expect from a country at war. But it's very far from ideal.
Olga Rudenko is the editor-in-chief of the Kyiv Independent, an English-language online news publication based in Ukraine. The origin story of her media outlet is an interesting one. Olga and many others in her team previously worked for the Kyiv Post. But because of their critical coverage of the Ukrainian government, the owner started putting pressure on the newsroom, trying to change their reporting.
And journalists revolted against that. And for that, we were all fired. And he said he's shutting down the Kyiv Post, and he then restarted it with the loyal staff that is more obedient. But we were, you know, we were on the street, and we were this group of idealistic in the best sense of the word, young journalists who just wanted to continue doing what we're doing, which is to be the English language voice of Ukraine.
In 2021, they started the Kyiv Independent with the goal of never having anyone tell them what to write about again. And the demand was there. Today, the Kyiv Independent is funded by 20,000 paying members from all around the world.
We founded the Kyiv Independent 3 months before the invasion, and everybody asks us, did you guys know that it was coming? Were you smart enough to know that Ukraine would need this in 3 months? And I'd be happy to say that yes, it was some, you know, planning on our part, but to be honest, not at all.
Olga and her team actually had a very different vision for the Kyiv Independent. They did not foresee having to cover war extensively.
Well, it's the kind of responsibility that I was definitely not ready for. Maybe the most difficult thing that we had to learn to do is to make these decisions about where it's safe to go. And especially in the first year of the full-scale invasion, I had to hold people back from going because people were so so enthusiastic, and it's a very young team. Mm. Most people are in their 20s and very early 30s. They had no sense of personal safety, and they just were so driven by the mission.
Olga told me that the war is not all they cover, but it takes up a lot of their resources, and it brings new challenges in terms of press freedom.
There is war censorship. There is a vague set of rules that was introduced by the government in the beginning of the full-scale invasion in 2022. They say that you can't report about the number of military equipment Ukraine has, or where it has it, or exact locations of Ukrainian troops, which all makes sense.
Yeah.
But then there is so much abuse of those rules. What ends up happening is you can get messages or phone calls from pretty much any agency that are going to tell you that something that you've written about them violates national security and is going to try to push you to take it down or to not write about it. At the same time, there were also several cases that were very worrying of government and the security service of Ukraine, well, basically spying on journalists. There were other cases of journalists being targeted with conscription orders, for example, as a retribution for their reporting.
In other words, Olga says some Ukrainian officials are weaponizing the war to stop journalists from exposing the things they want to remain hidden. Olga is convinced that investigative reporting, like on corruption, will help her country, not harm it.
All the things that you hear about Ukraine that are bad, like corruption or some shortcomings of the military, you know of them usually because Ukrainian journalists uncovered them. And they're the first ones to yell about that. And I think it's great. I think it's a sign of a very healthy society, that of a society that demands to know the truth.
For Olga, journalism is more than a job.
I think I find this job helping me cope with the war a lot. Whenever you see something really horrible, whenever, I don't know, you see a Russian attack on a civilian city in Ukraine that just completely destroyed an apartment building, and you look at the picture and you think this apartment building looks like just like the one where I grew up in my city. And before you go down, you spiral down in that, you know, that dark place, your journalist identity kicks in and you think, okay, who are we sending there? How are we covering this story? And you just make all those decisions, and it gives you a framework in which to process it. I don't know how it's going to be down the line. Mm. I don't know if it's something I'm bottling up and suppressing, and we'll just talk, you know, come out in a therapy session in 10 years. But for now, it's helping me. And it's also the feeling, just the feeling of purpose, the feeling of mission, the feeling of, in this time, having something that I can personally do to be on the right side of history.
Olga Rudenko, editor-in-chief of the Kyiv Independent, there, ending this press freedom special on a note of purpose and defiance. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Laura Kabelka in Germany. Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio program from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Laura Kabelka in Berlin. We'll be going on a journey to find out where prisons came from. In this episode, our colleagues at DW's Curious History podcast, Don't Drink the Milk, Rachel Stewart and Charlie Shield will take us from prison's birthplace to the Netherlands, to Scandinavia, and ask, who is prison actually serving?
I want to take you somewhere. You might not have been here before, but some things will seem familiar. It's a place you've probably always been aware of, but you've never wanted to end up. Prison. Have you ever stopped to think, what's the purpose of this place? Is it retribution?
Kind of punishment for punishment's sake. Somebody deserves to be punished for the wrong they've committed.
Deterrence?
Basically scare people so they no longer want to commit crime, or that other people watching don't want to commit crime.
Incapacitation?
Removing the person's ability to commit crime, in this case by taking them out of society.
Or rehabilitation?
Trying to figure out what is, you know, quote, wrong with the person, and then trying to, again, quote, fix them by giving them, you know, whatever tools it is that they need to not want to commit crime in the future.
Who are prisons actually there to serve? And in any case, what's the alternative? I'm Rachel Stewart, and this is Don't Drink the Milk, the curious history of things. Today, producer Charlie and I are on the trail of prisons. When did we start locking people up? And is it time for a jailbreak?
Chinese whispers.
Telefono senza fili.
Telephone.
Kulak dan kulak.
Stelepas.
He's watching the telephone.
Telefono abis.
Uche telephone.
Russian scandal.
Don't drink the milk.
In general, I've always kind of been afraid of institutions. Even now when I go to like Eastern State Penitentiary, it's that same sort of feeling of just like, oh my God, this place gives me the creeps. Like, I'm in awe of it, but I'm also just like, oh, this is just, there's something about it that I just, heebie-jeebies.
Even though real life prisons kind of freak Ashley Rubin out, she's devoted a large chunk of her life to studying them. Ever since her first class on the history of crime and punishment in her sophomore year of university.
I'm a professor at the University of Hawaii at Manoa in the Department of Sociology.
Before she became a walking encyclopedia for prisons, Ashley assumed they'd just been a feature of society since time immemorial. In fact, before Bed as a Child, she used to pray that all bad people go to prison, because that just seemed like the obvious place for them to go.
So, like everybody else, I thought prisons were something that we just always had.
But we haven't.
The very first prison was Massachusetts in 1785, followed by Connecticut in 1790 and Pennsylvania in 1794.
We had been locking people up for centuries before this, yes, but not always in prisons. Because jail and prison are kind of different. Basically, jails are supposed to be short-term, and prisons.
I define prisons as places that we punish people convicted of usually serious crimes, but definitely crimes, for long periods of time. And if you use that definition, then basically prisons emerged about after the American and French Revolutions, and especially in the United States after the American Revolution.
There's actually some emerging research that ancient Rome had prisons too. But for whatever reason, they didn't last. And for most of Western history, putting people away for long periods of time wasn't used as a punishment. But as we know, life back then was hardly a picnic. So what did they do?
Capital punishment in the American colonies and then in the new United States, the dominant form was hanging. In other places, especially in Europe, you could get much more torturous-based punishments, including things like boiling, burning, stoning to death, like being crushed under stones, like really gruesome executions.
Then when it came to the corporal stuff, it wasn't as fatal, but it definitely got gruesome too.
Branding and whipping were common corporal punishments, as was time spent in the pillory or the stocks, which are these wooden devices where your head would be kind of embedded between two boards along with your hands. And in some cases, your feet would be in a separate set of boards. So either you'd be forced to stand or forced to sit. And you'd be essentially in the town square being exposed to the derision of, you know, whoever wanted to stop by and make fun of you, scold you, and throw fruit at you or stones. So those were our kind of main forms of punishment. Oh, also cutting off, cutting off hands, ears.
It sounds pretty extreme, but in many ways, Ashley says, life back then was extreme.
Life was a lot more violent and fatal for people at the time. It was also pretty normalized. This is just what you do, in the same way that, you know, prison is kind of normal to us today.
Nonetheless, more and more people weren't okay with it.
Partly because religious ideas were changing, partly because the Enlightenment happened, partly because our ideas about our rights and our relationship to the state was also changing.
Religion, the Enlightenment, the novel idea of human rights. All of these things were an important part of paving the way for a new system of punishment to emerge.
So on the one hand, you have this growing concern about capital and corporal punishments for a variety of reasons, humanitarian reasons, but also kind of practical concerns. So jurors and in some cases judges and in some cases private prosecutors were less comfortable bringing these cases or finding somebody guilty or insisting on the case in the first place because they thought, well, you know, the crime was just a property crime or it was kind of a minor crime or this is a person's first offense. I really don't want them to get executed for this.
People increasingly started to feel that killing someone for stealing, for breaking and entering, or not paying a debt was kind of an overreaction. And if it was supposed to deter other people from committing crime, well, that wasn't working either.
As much as it might work on people who would otherwise be law-abiding people, a lot of times the people who are not law-abiding, it's not going to work on them. A lot of times they're committing crimes that are not really about, like, you know, a rational cost-benefit analysis of, if I do this, I will, you know, get this really bad punishment. So you have a lot of people just saying, our punishments don't work.
There was also a growing chorus of dissatisfaction with jails. Because remember, jails did exist for short-term stints. Everyone was thrown in together, young and old. So people used to call them schools of vice, where young'uns could learn the tricks of the trade from seasoned crims. They were also usually privately owned and prone to corruption. Plus, jails tended to be extremely dirty and unsanitary. Basically, big, gross dungeons of disease.
And so there's this big movement to reform the jails.
Enter. Long-term confinement in purpose-built prisons. But even back then, not everyone was convinced.
There was a lot of concern about what happens when you put people in prisons behind closed doors.
People would no longer be punished for their crimes in public. Behind closed doors, it might be too harsh. It might not be harsh enough. Either way, it was seen as undemocratic. And some people were scared about how the authorities might abuse this system. Plus, people were asking, what's actually crueler and more extreme? Whipping people, branding them, killing them, or locking them away in prison?
Some people worried that the prison was more extreme than capital punishment, which is, of course, a debate that continues today.
Of course, a couple of centuries later, neither capital nor corporal punishment have entirely disappeared. More than 50 countries still have the death penalty. But prison as a punishment has well and truly gone global. Every single country has a prison system. And around 11.5 million people are currently incarcerated around the world. From England, Belgium and France to Cyprus, Sri Lanka and the Congo, prisons far and wide struggle with overcrowding and understaffing. Most prisons are places of endemic violence, substance abuse, poor mental health and chronic disease.
They're also sites of stark racial inequality. In Australia, First Nations people make up 33% of the prison population, even though they only make up 3% of the general population. Move on over to the US, the birthplace of the modern prison, and things are not much better. In one of the richest countries in the world, black people are incarcerated at a rate nearly 5 times that of white people. It's also home to the world's largest prison population, there are nearly 2 million people locked up in the US, which costs American taxpayers billions of dollars every year.
And if one of the main goals is to reform people, the return on that investment is pretty low. In the US, the latest stats show that 66% of people released from prison are rearrested within 3 years, and a massive 82% are rearrested within a decade.
You're pushed out of school and prepared for a life of incarceration. You know, prison is going to be in your future, and they started by removing you from your peers, getting kicked out of class, getting suspended, expelled. And a lot of kids who are suspended or expelled, they have a lot more time on their hands to be up to no good. So it kind of just kills your self-esteem, your motivation, your drive, and lets you know, look, I'm no good. I'm not meant to be a normal part of society.
Amari Emili was one of many young black boys to end up in the so-called school-to-prison pipeline. He grew up in poverty in Washington State.
We were living on welfare, you know, and just trying to get by the way we could, kind of trapped in survival mode.
He cycled through 15 different schools, through foster homes and homeless shelters. He grew up with three of his five sisters, and his mum and dad, like most adults in his life, were hooked on crack cocaine.
Whether it was their friends or aunties, uncles, like I was just surrounded by kids who weren't quite being cared for due to their parents' addiction to crack cocaine. It was rough. It was rough for me growing up, and I had to engage in activities to support myself that no young kid really should have to do.
Activities like shoplifting, for clothes, for food, things that were often lacking at home. Eventually, at the age of 21, once Amari had two kids of his own, he found a way to make money fast.
I didn't really know what crime I was committing, but I knew it was illegal. I knew what I was doing wasn't right.
Bank fraud.
I looked at it like, oh, my victim's the bank. They got all kinds of money. So I didn't really look at it like I was harming people. And I thought that it was my way out of my circumstances.
Instead of setting him free from the poverty, addiction, and neglect of his upbringing, though, it sent him to prison. Amari spent almost 2 years behind bars.
It's the worst environment you can imagine. You know, you're stuck, you can't leave, you can't see your family, you can't hug your mom, can't hug your kids, eating the worst food in the world. You know, there's just constant worries about your safety and well-being. You never know what's going to happen inside of there. So you're kind of on edge, feel like you got to protect yourself. Like, prison was horrible, you know, just like it's designed to be.
Amari remembers feeling bored, scared, and depressed. There was an us versus them mentality between guards and the people incarcerated, and there was little talk of well-being and rehabilitation.
I don't feel like I was treated like a human being at any stage. They put negative labels on folks like criminal, convict, felon, murderer, rapist, identity thief, you know, all these things, because then they can justify the things that they do to you. If they look at you as a human being, it's hard to justify putting someone in a cage and telling them you can only come out 1 hour a day, and you know, you don't really have access to showers every day. You know, we're gonna take your visits away from you, or we're gonna take your phone calls away from you, where you just have no communication with the outside world or your family. Like, it's hard to do that to people that you see as human beings.
This is one person's experience inside, in the place where modern-day prisons were invented. But is there a way to do prisons without stripping people of their humanity?
Okay, we're nearly there.
It is weird that we're walking through the woods
to a prison. It's dark and cold. Are you getting penal vibes yet?
Creepy and fancy at the same time, so far.
It's cool.
Yeah.
I have some bars in the windows upstairs.
Oh, yeah.
Well, this is the fanciest prison I've ever seen.
It is indeed fancy.
Hi.
Yeah.
We're looking for the Fallon. Are we... Oh, we're in the right place. Great. Thank you. Thanks. The booking is for Charlie Shield.
Yep, you heard that right. We're checking in to prison. Well, sort of. The Fallon Hotel in Alkmaar in the Netherlands used to be the Schutterswei prison, which closed in 2013. Some of the hotel rooms have original cell doors. The pipes running along the corridors and bars on the windows give it that authentic feel. And apparently, one of the country's most notorious criminals was imprisoned right here.
What was his name?
So his name was Willem Frederik Holleder. He was a Dutch gangster.
Ooh.
So he was sentenced to 11 years imprisonment for his involvement in the kidnapping of Heineken president Freddie Heineken for a 35 million ransom.
As in the beer company? This is like such a Dutch story.
That's true.
This is not even the only prison hotel in the Netherlands. Many old prison buildings have been repurposed here as hotels, cultural centres, or temporary accommodation for asylum seekers. Some of the buildings are actually pretty cool. One reason for shutting down the old prisons was simply an effort to modernise and streamline facilities. Older, smaller buildings are less efficient to run. But there was another reason too.
The Dutch prison crisis. A shortage of prisoners. Criminal shortage leads to near empty prisons in this European country. Why are there so few prisoners in the Netherlands?
The Netherlands is one of the few countries worldwide to see prison populations fall in recent years. Between 2005 and 2016, prison rates dropped by nearly 50%. It has since increased slightly, but remains comparatively very low. So, while other countries have prisons filled way over capacity, how did this small nation in Northwest Europe buck the trend? Well, crime rates did fall in the country too, but there's more to it than that. How you actually define crime will affect how many people end up behind bars. Take drugs, for example. The Netherlands has some of the most relaxed laws on drug possession in the world. So someone who would end up in prison in, say, the US, might not end up in prison in the Netherlands. Then, once you've defined the crime, you settle on a suitable punishment. In the Netherlands, that's often meant community service or a fine, rather than prison time. And even when prison time has been handed out, the sentences have traditionally been pretty short. Hence, fewer people locked up at any one time. Back at the old prison hotel, we find we're not the only ones here who are really interested in the hotel's former identity. We spot several Dutch tour groups being taken around the grounds.
I don't understand that they're doing this. When I go to an hotel, I go to a nice hotel with a bubble blot and something like that. But I understand that normal people, they never come in this world. That's exciting for them, but not for me, of course.
Edith Levering is one of the tour guides here. She tells us that she'd much prefer to stay in a nice hotel with bubble bath rather than a renovated old prison like this one. That's because she actually used to work here when it really was a prison. She's also worked in many other prisons around the country as a social worker. And she thinks that Dutch people often have a rose-tinted view of what it's like to be incarcerated in their country.
They think it's like an hotel. You get your food, you get your clothes, you get your everything. But that isn't, because you cannot say anything about your own will. You cannot open your own door. You cannot go outside when you want. You sit and wait. That makes you, I don't know the word, afhankelijk. Complete afhankelijk.
We look the word up. It means dependent. There's very little free will when you're locked up. That's kind of the point. Prison, even in the Netherlands, is no hotel.
Don't Drink the Milk's exploration of crime and punishment continues after the break. That's here on Inside Europe.
Thank you.
Yeah, we've had a little look around. It's really nice.
Nice, yeah. One of the best buildings of the university.
Ah.
So can I get you anything to drink?
We've come to the criminology department of Leiden University, about an hour from Amsterdam,
to meet with Esther van Hinneken. She spends lots of time in Dutch prisons.
And how many have you visited?
I've visited all the prisons in the Netherlands.
What's your favourite?
She researches what she calls the prison climate. Basically, the conditions and atmosphere, what life is like for people incarcerated there.
I think the Netherlands is probably known to have a pretty humane prison system, which probably has to do with the good relationships that people incarcerated tend to have with staff, for example. So staff are very enthusiastic and passionate about their jobs. And so I do also come away from prisons often feeling quite inspired and grateful that we have people working in these prisons that actually feel so strongly about making the day a bit better for people who are incarcerated there.
One potential function of prison is rehabilitation, and Dutch prisons take this pretty seriously, offering counselling, education opportunities, vocational training, basically preparing people for life after prison. The idea is that this will benefit both them and society.
I think actually prison can be an important ground for change, also sometimes for positive societal change, because, well, it's funny to say maybe, but it's a captive audience in a way. And it's sometimes when people have very chaotic lives on the outside, actually prison can offer that opportunity for change because people are less distracted.
For people with substance abuse problems, those in abusive relationships, or caught up in a life of crime, Esther believes that prison, at least Dutch prison, can kind of break the cycle.
Prison, in a sense, can make it easier to reach those people, to proactively provide that help. So I think if we see prison maybe as more of a societal responsibility to repair some of the problems that, you know, and maybe inadequate systems have sometimes caused, or sometimes it can be due to family circumstances that people have ended up on the margins of society. We should see it as a responsibility to pull back people into society.
Measuring the success of rehabilitation is really difficult. Prison populations have gone down here, but reconviction rates haven't changed drastically. They're around 45% in the first 2 years after release. But Esther told us that she got to know many people who did personally benefit from the opportunities offered to them in prison. However, something's changing in the Netherlands.
Netherlands looks set to have its most right-wing government in decades after a deal was reached.
Dutch society and politics have seen a strong swing to the right, and Esther says this is already having an impact on their prison system.
Yes, I think the relationship between sort of the more right-wing populism and the demand for more punitive sentencing, it kind of goes hand in hand, right? Because it's traditionally something that is claimed by the right wing, sort of more law and order, more stricter sentencing. So that's very much a sort of trend, both in the politics and in the public domain.
As the political landscape changes, sentencing is increasing. Recently, Dutch prisons have also been struggling with staff shortages, which means that people incarcerated there are cooped up for more hours of the day.
So, Dutch prisons might be more humane than most, and have a stronger focus on welfare. But they're not immune to problems. That goes for prison systems in Scandinavia too. You know the ones in countries like Norway and in Finland, famed for being free-range and all-inclusive.
There's a lot of misunderstanding about how those prisons work, and even how they work in their own country, and also like what's necessary for them to work.
Prison history sociologist Ashley Rubin says that despite all of the positive press, these more progressive, open prisons, where people are given more freedom, aren't as common as you might think.
The open prison model is actually a minority within these countries. It's the one that gets a lot of attention. So a lot of times, you know, like there are documentaries that focus on these differences. That's not the modal prison in these countries. That's basically a low security prison. They still have high security prisons. They actually have supermax prisons just like we do.
And in any case, this isn't some straightforward, one-size-fits-all prison system. First of all, a big part of the reason why some countries have successfully built some kinder-looking prisons is because traditionally their societies look different than bigger, more diverse countries like the US.
Their demographics are very different from ours. People are much more likely to support kind of lenient, kind of liberal-seeming punishments when they think that the person experiencing the punishment is somebody like them. Oftentimes, that means demographically like them, culturally like them, and so on. And a lot of times people are not comfortable with that when it's somebody who's seen as an other.
If you can see yourself in prison, you're more likely to want the conditions to be better.
The Scandinavian-style prisons work really well in Scandinavian countries where, you know, they're oftentimes targeted towards people who look like the kind of the stereotypical version of a Scandinavian person. As the immigrant population increases, especially the immigrant community of color and especially like Muslim heritage people, that increasingly is making people more kind of oppositional towards these punishments. And so that's becoming a problem.
As Scandinavian countries also deal with changing demographics and politics, they're beginning to struggle with more issues like overcrowding and public pressure for harsher sentencing.
But these nations do tend to have lower crime rates, and that's where people can get confused.
So people think we can just transplant these prisons in the United States and suddenly it's going to fix, you know, our crime problem. There are so many layers of misunderstanding about like why that's not going to work. And inevitably, people are going to be disappointed.
That's because a better resourced prison is also not a ticket to solving crime, Ashley says.
So there are a lot of things we could be doing to reduce crime that basically have nothing to do with punishment. There are other things like just social policies. And a lot of times these are things that they do in a lot of Northern European countries where we look at their punishment system and we say, oh, like their punishment system is so effective, but it's not their punishment system, it's their social system.
Social policies like healthcare, child support, affordable education, a decent minimum wage, mental health support, and stable housing. Basically, providing a strong social safety net that makes life easier for people and harder for them to fall through the cracks if they're born into disadvantage. Policies that countries in Northern Europe, like the Netherlands, Norway, and Finland, tend to have in spades, and that the US has long struggled to realise.
All of these things are actually, you know, pretty effective at reducing crime. It's just they're things that, at least in the United States, a lot of people don't necessarily see the value of doing, or they kind of don't like the idea of just giving things out kind of undeserved. But at the end of the day, it's in our self-interest to do these things because it would make us so much safer from crime.
If you still haven't had enough of prisons, you can find the full episode on any podcast platform. Don't want the conversation to end? You can drop us a line at insideeurope@dw.com or leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/insideeurope. This program was produced by me, Laura Kabelka, with help from Charlie Shield and Kate Laycock. Our sound engineer was Jürgen Kuhn. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Germany.